He is a scientist, best-selling author of 5 books, AI entrepreneur, and a declared AI skeptic that talks about the road to AI we can trust. Please welcome Gary Marcus to Dataklubben.
Welcome to Dataklubben. Welcome to Data Day. We are live here at Data Day, which is a conference in Denmark, where we are gathering more than 400 people that are very, very passionate about data. And welcome to Gary Marcus. So you are actually sitting here next to us. You live a long way from Denmark, but you've traveled all the way here with your family. And what the best timing is that we just had an introduction to GPT-4 yesterday.
That's right. That GPT-4 was released as my airplane, which was 2 hours late, took off from Berlin. So I was texting people as my flight was about to take off saying, what's in it? Tell me. And then I had to like go through the whole flight not knowing what was in it.
Exactly. And I just saw on Substack, on your Substack, that you just mentioned success and failures related to GPT-4. So let us know, what are your immediate thoughts about this?
So my immediate thoughts are, of course, it's really cool. You take a model that big, you train it on that much data. How much data? I don't know. Because they won't say in their paper. And of course, it's going to do something interesting. It passes a lot of exams, which is pretty cool. LSATs and SATs and all of these kinds of things. And it has a vision module. We don't know that much about it as we sit here less than 24 hours after the release. And then there are the things I don't like. So it is cool. And one other thing, people are actually using it in apps, and that's interesting. So, for example, Khan Academy is actually using it. We don't have a measure yet on how much it helps, but it's interesting that people are adopting it, whereas the earlier versions weren't really adopted that much. So it's clearly going to have some real-world impact. But I look at it as a scientist, because that's really what I am. And as a scientist, I think, A, I'm kind of disappointed in certain ways, and B, I don't think it's addressing what I think is the interesting question in AI. So the interesting question in AI is, how do we make the system can actually think and be reliable? And this is not that. It's still hallucinating, just like the earlier versions. So as a scientist, I don't think it's addressing the question that we really want to know about artificial general intelligence. How do we make a flexible general purpose system that can reason about the world in a reliable way? It's still not doing that. It's still like GPT-3. It's hit or miss. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. The most interesting tweet that I saw in the kind of initial coverage of it is it was doing really well on some code exams until 2021, computer coding exams, and then it failed all the questions in 2022. Well, what does that tell you? It says it's mostly relying on stuff that's kind of stored in its database, but there's some kind of flexibility that's still missing there. I'm not surprised, because I don't think it works that much different from GPT-3. But that actually takes me to my second major concern, which is there's no science here. No. They say nothing about what the data are. They say nothing about how the architecture actually works, how many more parameters there are than the earlier ones. And so from the perspective of science, to have people make these big announcements with all these graphs and all this hype, and then you don't know what's in it, like, that's not really an advancement for science. It's actually kind of the opposite. It puts us in this world where we don't know what the science is. We don't know what we've got. And if, you know, it can work on 2021 questions and not 2022 programming questions, or not about facts, but just they change the exam a little bit. Well, we don't know how to trust it. And putting that out there in the real world, letting it roam free, as we saw with Sydney and Bing and all that, I don't know. Our results may not be so great. So the way I put it, in this article that I wrote, was sort of my hot take, I guess you call it. My first take on it is it's a big step for hype. You know, it's exciting and all that, but it's not necessarily a big step forward for humanity, for artificial general intelligence. You know, we're going to have to wait and see here.
And Gary, I have followed you the last couple of months, and you've really been busy. So the hype is out there. But I think the reason also, when we are talking and reading some of your stuff, you're saying there's some good things about it, but there's also very bad things about the way we are taking ChatGPT and data science at the moment. Set some words on that, please.
I mean, I don't even know how much it has to do with data science in a way, right? I mean, it's almost like the antithesis of data science. You've got this great t-shirt on saying data is beautiful. We don't know what the data are.
No.
Right? And so it's the worst kind of black box. We have nothing, no insight into what's in it. And when it succeeds, we don't know exactly why it succeeded. It's completely opaque. When it fails, we don't know why it failed. And we don't know which of those cases there are. So a good data scientist should be saying, hey, I've got these data. I'm trying to make these predictions. I want to know when I'm going to get it right and when I'm going to get it wrong. How good is this? Like, what is the regime where it doesn't work anymore? You know, first thing that you ask in statistics, if you take like a good undergraduate statistics classes, you learn that there are assumptions around your data. You know, this test will work if the data are normally distributed, but if they're not, then maybe it's not a reliable test anymore. We have no information like that whatsoever here. Like, is the right generalization? It works on exam questions up to the year 2021, but not after. Like, that would be a horrible generalization if it's true. But I have no idea if it's true. Like, we were just like grasping at straws. We don't have the data here, even on what data are inside it. How, you know, I'm repeating myself, but like,
yeah,
that's phenomenal from the perspective of data science, that you should have a black box that you have no real characterization of, other than I tried a bunch of experiments and some of them kind of work, you know, on Tuesdays, but not on Thursdays.
Why do you think that OpenAI is launching this with these limitations?
I mean, I think it's commercial considerations. I mean, it's not really a scientific advance, in as much as without any disclosure of what's going on, it's very difficult to say what's really happening. Let me rewind a second. You know, the critical question in neural networks for at least three decades, since I wrote about it in 1998, but you could argue even before then, has been about generalization. And what we have known is that there's a problem we call extra distribution shift, or distribution shift goes by different names. So the basic idea is, I've got a system, it works in some regime, and then you move outside of the data that you've seen before to something that, you know, is a little bit different in some way, and your system may not work anymore. So humans have a lot of limitations, but we're better at dealing with shifts in regime relative to what we've seen before. We've always known that's a weakness of these systems. And the question has always been how well you can cope with that. How much does it matter in your real world system and so forth? And if you have no transparency into the data for a particular system, you can't even speak to that question. And if I can just move away from GPT-4 for a second, let's think about driverless cars. We're actually having the same problem. So driverless cars, we have demos that are beautiful, right? You know, they'll drive you around Phoenix or San Francisco or whatever, but we don't have them as real world products. So we're sitting here in Copenhagen. I don't think there are any driverless cars running here.
Not at the moment.
And hopefully
actually,
not.
Copenhagen's a relatively easy city. It's orderly and so forth. You know, imagine that we meet in the next conference in Mumbai where there are rickshaws that aren't in the training set and there's more pedestrians and the roads are a little
cows
bit less rural.
Cows and whatever. Yeah.
Like, we have no reason to think that these systems would be able to deal with those data that are outside the distribution. And so the problem with driverless cars is demos are cheap and products that actually work don't exist yet after, you know, $100 billion. And it'll be interesting to see with GPT-4 what actually makes it to a real world product. I think the most interesting question right now is can we revise the paradigm of search altogether? So a lot of people are interested in doing that, right? So
at least let me take you back. One of the things you said, that it was some kind of commercial aspect right now about the ChatGPT. Normally, Rosa and I, beside this podcast, we work in a data consulting company, and they're asking, what should we invest in? So the companies is out there and trying to get on the road, but they don't know what to do because data is data, but ChatGPT is out there. So one of the questions, what should companies invest in at the moment?
I mean, it's too early to say in a way. So, you know, it turned out, I think, that in the case of GPT-3, that there was a lot of talk, but not a lot of actual commercial application. My understanding is that the amount of revenue made was actually relatively modest.
Okay.
So from what I understand, the biggest application of GPT-3 was Jasper. And from what I hear, it made about $70 million last year. And what it did is copywriting, mostly like for search engines to like optimize blogs and stuff like that. I would not say it's the most pro-social use of AI that one might imagine. Doing these, you know, almost like fake blogs for sort of marginal blogs so that you could optimize your website and so forth. So we had that application, but a lot of things that people wanted to do weren't really reliable enough. Right? That's a critical question here. So like I was about to talk about chat search.
Yeah.
You know, take that as an example. Can we build that?
Yeah.
Well, the problem with chat search is we understand the paradigm now. It would be so cool if you could type in a sentence and get an answer on anything you want. And you can kind of do that, but sometimes the answers are wrong. Like somebody gave me an example a couple of days ago. They typed in about SVB, the bank that collapsed. And it made up a story. It said that the collapse was caused by GPT-5.
Oh my God.
GPT-5 does not exist yet, as far as I know. And if it does, it's only like in some, you know, back room, so to speak, at OpenAI. So it did not have any role in the collapse. It hallucinated is what it did. And so those hallucinations where it just makes stuff up are still there in 4.
Yeah.
There are fewer of them in 3. But you have to ask for your commercial application, you know, I want to use this stuff. What matter, you know, what's at stake if there's a hallucination or if there's some kind of toxic behavior or so forth? So like if you're going to use it as a chat bot in the context of a bank and you make an error, you could really upset a customer. You said to the customer, you know, you have $1 million in the bank.
Why not?
And then
using
they discover that they only have 800,000 or whatever. Maybe this is the wrong example there. But, you know, if the financial figures turn out to be wrong, somebody can be very, very upset.
Yeah.
And so you have to ask domain by domain, what is the cost of error here? What is the likelihood of these hallucinations? And going back to what I said earlier, we don't have a lot of data here. Okay, you can pass the SAT, but the SAT, you know, they have a lot of sample exams. When I want to use this data to, you know, predict something about traffic in this city or whatever, like, how well is that going to work? How much is it going to make it up? We don't know those answers yet.
Yeah.
And so that makes it hard as, you know, a consultant to say you should use it here or not, because we don't really have clarity yet.
Gary, I want to ask you about your worriness, because you talk a lot and you write a lot about you being worried for the world and also the way we work with AI.
Yeah.
So should we worry in general, or is it just something that we should do temporary because of practical things like that maturity in technology and stuff like that?
Well, I like to think of AI right now as being in its terrible teenage years. It's starting to be powerful enough to do stuff, but it's like it doesn't have a frontal cortex to tell it exactly what's a good idea and a bad idea. It has these kind of marginal guardrails that sort of work and sort of don't. I think that gives us a lot of reason to worry. I wrote an essay the other day about whether I should be more worried about and whether you and everybody else should be more worried about the short term or the long term.
Yeah.
And answer is not clear. The short term, the biggest worry in my mind is around misinformation. So you can use these tools, maybe not GPT-4 with its guardrails, but if you could get a version without, or you can get similar models that are on the dark web. If you're a bad actor, you can use that to make an enormous amount of very plausible propaganda that, you know, the ordinary person's not going to be able to detect as not made by humans and not true. And that's going to affect elections probably forever. That you have this new tool that can produce misinformation in much greater volume than before. That's a very serious worry. Now, here's another serious worry. Just yesterday, a company called Adept AI raised $350 million as a Series B, to basically hook up large language models to all the world's software. And it's not hard to think about scenarios where that might not be very good, right? If you have software that hallucinates and it's not reliable and you hook it up to air traffic control or, you know, trains or things like that, you could easily have accidents. You could have things that look like they're sabotage that cause wars, even though they aren't actually sabotage from the outside. All kinds of kind of crazy things could happen when you put AI that's really not as clever as it looks on a lot of problems. And most people don't understand the limitations on it. So they're going to be tempted to apply it everywhere. You're going to get a lot of short-term reward out of that. But they're often going to be kind of hidden problems. And so there's a lot of risks around that. And then in the longest term, we want to have AI that has values.
But yeah.
We're moving towards an AI that doesn't really have values. It just has examples. And it doesn't even reason over those examples. It just looks for matches in the space of words and sentences and things like that. And the more power that has, the dodgier it seems to me. Like, I just had this very interesting conversation with Stuart Russell on Sam Harris's podcast, Making Sense, about AGI risk and values. And Stuart, I think, wants to induce values from experience. And I want to have some innate constraint on that.
Mm.
And the thought that we can't even sort that out among us AI researchers, like, it just scares me.
Yeah. I have one thing, because you've been working in the area of data science for a long time. Are we missing out the word data on this part right now?
I mean, I guess there's interesting ways to think about it. So this system, you know, GPT-4 is trained on a lot of data. The rest of the world don't have data on what data those are.
Mm.
There's another interesting thing, which is that these systems don't have kind of standard hooks to load in data and interpret that data. Like, you can't say, here's Wikipedia, absorb it, and now be faithful to Wikipedia.
Mm.
So it's going to make, I mean, for example, Wikipedia is not going to tell you that GPT-5 was responsible for SVP.
No.
You know, it's not going to be in the data set. But you can't only say things that are validated relative to Wikipedia, which might actually be helpful. You can't say that to these systems. They don't know how to take that data in. And so, you know, data are all around us in many different forms. And so the question is open-ended, I guess, in a certain sense. But I would say that these systems have a very strange relationship to data, and we have a very strange relationship to them because we don't know which data they're trained on. And since everything depends on whether the test is close enough to the training data, to not know what's inside of it is to be in a great state of mystery.
We are talking about AI. So maybe one of the questions to follow up on is that if you have to predict something about OpenAI, what are we doing with OpenAI within 20 years from now?
With the company itself?
Yeah.
I think it will still be a subsidiary of Microsoft. So, I mean, the way that they're set up with their deal, I guess they could renegotiate it, is basically they are functioning as a subsidiary right now. Microsoft gets half the profits and calls the shots and so forth. And there's an escape clause, so to speak. If they make $250 billion, then control reverts back to OpenAI and to the nonprofit that sits on top of it.
If we predict it in 20 years, what is going to be useful?
I mean, I think in 20 years we will have different technology that's more reliable. I think in 20 years we'll look back at this and say, that was cute what they were trying to do, and it pulled off a lot of stuff, but it didn't really work.
Yeah.
And
I think we must wait for the teenager to grow up.
Yeah, I think, you know, in 20 years the teenager will have grown up and we'll be like, that was rough. You know, the teenager was like crashing the car and like it was cool.
Drinking too much.
They were drinking too much. They were making all these hallucinations. Maybe it was not drink, but something else. And, you know, it was interesting watching them as a teenager, but maybe that wasn't quite the right way to go. And we're glad we're past that now.
And also, just to be in this area, we as parents right now, we should be more literate, AI literate, on how to cope with these technologies.
Not just parents, but definitely parents. Parents, children, everybody in society suddenly has to be AI literate. Like, I've been trying to teach people AI literacy for a while. That's what my 2019 book was about. But nobody cared then.
No, it was too soon.
It was too soon. The book was too early. Now, I think it's incumbent on everybody. Like, then it was like, if you're an intellectual, you might be interested in where all this stuff is going. And now it's like everybody has to deal with it. There's no escape. You know, whatever your job is, there's going to be some impact on your job. Hopefully it's good. Might be that you lose your job, depending on what it is. Everybody is going to be asked to use these tools in what they do. Not everybody, but, you know, a very large part of the population is going to have to use these tools in some way or another. And I think it's important that everybody in the society realize that the tools are actually limited, that they're unpredictable, that they're unreliable, and they're untrustworthy. And although they're super fun to play with, you can't count on them. Like, people need to understand that.
And let's maybe end up with a positive mindset about OpenAI and AI. in common. What do you think we should look into if we're in a part you want to use data science for something? What is the future for us if we're in a mindset of positive thing doing?
I think what we should be positive about is not exactly what we have right now, but the possibilities that AI might eventually offer. I think that requires moving off the path that we're on right now. I once said deep learning is hitting a wall. The field didn't like that too much, but lately Jan LeCun has said that large language models are an off-ramp, which I think is a different way of saying the same thing. We need to get back on the highway of AI. And if we do, and I think we can, that's the part I'm optimistic about, that if, I think eventually we can, then we can build AI that, for example, can cope with, can help us, then we can get to AI that can help us discover new things in medicine, new things in technology, help us build elder care robots, take care of the elderly as we have a demographic shift. So I think there's lots and lots of potential for AI still.
Yeah.
But I think we do have to get off this off-ramp, as exciting as this stop is, and get back on the highway.
Thank you so much for coming, Gary. It was a pleasure having you in Dataklubben.
Thanks very much for having me.